Gideon, good afternoon.
That's it.
Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our regular fortnightly discussion group, hosted by the Consistent Democrats. This week, Comrade Susan is going to be giving a talk on Christian Zionism. What is it and how does it differ from Judaic Judaism, Zionism? Susan, how long do you reckon it will be?
It's as long as a piece of string, I'm afraid, Paul. But I've got quite a few slides, and it just depends on, you know, whether people want to carry on, whether they find it interesting enough, and or whether they'd rather just ask some questions. So I can
okay, well,
in about 20, 30 minutes.
When you get to the last slide,
yeah,
and then when you've made your final remarks, I'll open it up for questions.
Yep.
In the meantime, comrades, where possible, could you ensure that your mic is muted and that only Susan has her mic on? Otherwise, it causes interference with the recording. And I remind comrades that we are being recorded. So when we come to the question and answers and general discussion, please make sure you keep it one at a time. Okay, Comrade Susan, go ahead.
Okay, there are quite a lot of slides. So as I'm going through, if the questions, if any questions appear to you, it might be a good idea to put them in the chat and then we'll go through them, or you can elaborate on them if the slides give you the answers, so you don't need to ask. Okay, so starting with these questions, I had to have I'm interested in the evolution of religion and in religions in general and ideologies as they change over time. So Christian Zionism not only turns out to be rather different to Judaic Zionism, but it's also very separate in terms of time and how these things have changed. So, if we look at a timeline of Zionism, originally Zionism, the apocalyptic literature, basically is between 168 BCE and 136 CE, where CE is the common era, BCE is obviously before the common era, and it was strictly Jewish because there was no Christianity, and it was really about the restoration of Israel's independence after the Hellenistic period, which is 331 BCE, when Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East amongst a large swathe of the country of the world, as opposed to the Roman Empire, which conquered it 63 BCE. But during that period, 168 to 136, you had a number of apocalyptic and Zionist preachers who were looking to either re-establish the Hasmonean royal family, or who were looking to establish an independent Israel. But it was strictly really based on Israel as an independent country that would be administered for Jews by Jews. Christian Zionism, however, doesn't really get much off the ground until the 1820s, and it has evolved, although I've said gradually over the 19th and 20th century, it has changed massively from that original idea. So the two are completely different. Now, in terms of the Jewish Zionism, obviously 168 BCE to 136 CE, that period includes the origin of Christianity itself. So it is inevitable that Christian Zionism is going to be rooted in the Jewish Zionism of that period. An apocalypse, as it was seen at the time, was a cataclysmic event. It could be revelatory in terms of an individual revelation that you were going to see in the form of enlightenment, or it could be a cataclysmic event, a volcanic eruption, a flood, and it was the idea of some, or even a conqueror, a new empire who would treat Israel and the Jewish people differently to the oppression that they had maybe suffered under a previous empire or religion. So the apocalypse, or the apocalyptic literature that shaped the teachings of Jesus as they were, as they have been shown in the New Testament, can be seen as originating from that, those various literature, which is why the books that I have put in, I've given you some dates for when they roughly align up, but they are 168 is the Maccabean Revolt, and the main books of the Old Testament are going to be Daniel, Enoch, and the Sibylline Oracles, which do not appear in the Old Testament or the New. But the sack of Jerusalem in AD 70 was a traumatic event for the Jewish people, because obviously it resulted in the destruction of the temple and the removal of all the sacred objects to Rome, where they have since disappeared. And the main apocalyptic literature that you will find, Revelations is the most famous book that people know, but obviously Baruch and Ezra. And there is a book which sometimes turns up in the Apocrypha, which is in the apocryphal writings, which is the Apocalypse of Abraham. There are other apocalyptic literature, and the Dead Sea Scrolls has been really important in providing us with an insight as to what some of the more difficult to understand references in the New Testament are now put in context, which obviously they were not during the 15th to 20th century before those discoveries. Now, Judaic Zionism differs because in their form of Zionism, they believe that Satan, who is whatever evil monster or whatever person, or sometimes it was an empire like the Roman Empire or the Greek Empire or the Assyrian Empire, but sometimes it was an individual. But Satan, as they saw evil personified, would be defeated. They would be locked up in hell for 1,000 years, and that would be their punishment, 1,000 years of hell before they were released again. Because in the Jewish apocalypse, even Satan gets probation rather than execution. It focuses on the restoration of the two messiahs. There was a priest king, or there was a priest and a king. The priest was the person who anointed the king with his divine authority, and the recovering, or the administration of Israel, involved the 12 judges for the gathering of the 12 tribes and the establishment of a peaceful and prosperous kingdom of God, i.e. Israel. Apocalyptic literature for the Christians during this time, which is basically up until 325 CE, is mostly Revelations, Daniel, and Enoch. And it was, those books are now believed to have been written between 250 BCE and 250 Common Era. It is not clear whether or not the people of Jesus's time would have seen them as thousands of years old, as divine inspiration, or whether they would have seen them as separated into the law, histories and literature, i.e. things like the Song of Solomon were seen as poems, inspirational poems, but they were still seen as literature. It is very obvious that the changeover which comes with the Reformation is that the handling of the Bible, particularly both the Old and the New Testament, treated every word in the Bible as the word of God, and that there was no understanding of it as separating out law, history, and literature. But the Dead Sea Scrolls show that Jesus was an apocalyptic preacher, and the Christian Messiah of the Nicene Creed and Constantine Singularism is very different to what would have been seen as that literature at the time. Now, I can go on to the next slide, can't I? So, what's Christian Zionism? Well, now it's defined as a theological and political movement. It's rooted in the belief of the divine mandate of the literal interpretation of the Christian Bible, with all of its words being divided into prophecies, fulfilled and unfulfilled, and historicity, by which I mean that every word of it is true and is the true history of both Christianity and Judaism. Now, that's rooted in the Puritan movements of Europe, Britain, and the American colonies of the 17th century. Now, most pundits trace Christian Zionism to the Puritans. I would say it is rooted in the Protestant Reformation, which, when it challenged the power of the Vatican, it translated the Bible into the vernacular. What you have to remember is that for more than 500 years, the Vatican had stopped the publication of the Bible in England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, into English. It was after the Nicene Convocation in 325, Jerome set about translating it into the Vulgate. The Vulgate Bible is in Latin, and if you didn't speak Latin, you couldn't read the Bible if it wasn't translated into your language. And in particular, when the Roman Catholic Church set out to not, shall we say, there were already Christians in Britain, because of the Roman Empire, but they reconverted it to the true Catholic faith in about AD 600 when they sent Augustine to Britain. There were English Bibles, or there were portions of the Bible translated into Anglo-Saxon, but after 1066 there was a complete ban on it. And in fact, most people don't realise that, you know, part of Bloody Mary, Mary the First's Tudor reconversion back to Catholicism, involved banning, in fact, burning all of the English translations of the Bible. There are some important deliberate mistranslations or translational differences that included Jerome's translation of Genesis, for example, in the story of Adam and Eve, deliberately omits the fact that Adam and Eve were together when they were being tempted by the devil. And the sin of temptation is therefore the responsibility of both together. In Jerome's eyes, it's only Eve who is responsible for the temptation and sin, and ditto for the changing of the order of the Gospels, which was originally Matthew, John, Luke and Mark, rather than a more usual, what we now recognise as Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Martin Luther's posting of the 95 articles calling for reparation in 1517 led to a search for a higher authority by looking for better translations of the Bible, and the printing press allowed those translations to be transmitted, easily read by more people. Academics and church scholars collaborated with Greek and Hebrew scholars to use, as far as they saw, much older translations from Greek and Hebrew as well as Latin. And the emphasis on the original Greek and Hebrew, and eventually Aramaic writings, resulted in them contesting and dismantling the hierarchy which had been imposed by the Vatican by offering different vocabularies. Now, this resulted in the Tyndall Bible, which was interesting because of their use of non-hierarchical church. So it did away with bishops, and it particularly was interested in it's the establishment of congregational and Presbyterian. Now, lots of people associate Presbyterian importance with the fact that they recognize church elders. But what's interesting about Congregationalists, and I did not realize until I started researching this, is that Congregationalists only really believed in the church as their local community. And Oliver Cromwell was part and parcel, was a Congregationalist. And while he appealed to the Presbyterians, who were much more powerful in Scotland, with the English Civil War, it's part of that that challenges the power of the church to appoint kings as divine authority. And for some people would probably suggest that the reason for the Civil War and the execution of Charles I was that they could put the king on trial for treason. Okay, so stepping back a bit, the Nicene Creed, for many church scholars as they studied the Bible, it was realized that basically it's the Nicene Creed and the agreement of church with Constantine that allows them to declare other Christians heretics, which hadn't been done before, and which gave basically ultimate power to the bishops of Rome and Constantinople. And Rome as first amongst equals, the ability to convert divine authority, which led really to, for want of a better word, 1,000 years of wars and misery, while various popes, kings, emperors, etc., and the clergy made up, I've said, as rules for thee but not for me, because the canon law, which I don't know whether most of you have ever watched much of Robin Hood, but the constant complaint of the corruption of the church is entirely down to the fact that the clergy were subject to a different law and were allowed the privilege of completely different expectations of behaviour and punishment. And this again was part of the reason why the Reformation was so popular, despite the fact that it very quickly turned into something that was rather more oppressive, shall we say, than they expected it to be first. So, moving on. Just as the Nicene Creed had established power for the Vatican as it became, and the Vatican, of course, spent a lot of time imposing its authority with, as I said, massive amounts of horrendous wars and huge amounts of death and destruction. If you look at the history of the church between AD 325 and the 1500s, you are looking at one long mayhem of the Crusades, which involved an absolute bloodbath in Jerusalem while they took that, the destruction of Constantinople when the Third Crusade turned on them, and the devastation of France when they decided that they would get rid of the Cathars, which and the Albigenses and every other heretic nation that they decided. So, I'm going to move on to, as things calm down, the Hundred Years' War is another example of the efforts that the Catholic Church, I'm not sure that I can see what you can see on the screen. So I'm hoping that you are looking at the literal truth, Bible as history. You're all very
yes,
quiet.
We're on slide 6 to 27.
Good. Okay then. Well, if you're on 6, then it's not doing that. Okay. So, slide 6. Now, as things settled down, the shock.
We're now on the first Great Awakening, or did
that's
you want
right.
The
okay.
One?
So, the shock for the literal truth. Okay. So, slide 6. The execution of Charles Stuart for treason was a huge shock to the system. But obviously the restoration in 1660 with Charles II and the, in effect, rewriting of history, because Charles II, I don't know if people realise it, but he basically just pretended that the previous 20 years of the Commonwealth hadn't happened. And as the Restoration reinstated, shall we say, the Church and the Church of England as a, for want of a better word, a sort of pseudo-Roman Catholic Church, they maintained the thing. The Vatican insisted on, when the 1688 so-called Glorious Revolution happened and England became a constitutional democracy with no sight of a Roman Catholic heir, they maintained a sort of alternate history for the next 4 or so generations, so that Stuarts were claimed as the rightful kings of England and Scotland right up until I think the last Stuart died in about the 19th century, and eventually that's why the importance of the Pope recognizing Elizabeth as queen was so important to the Windsors. But again, all these things just pass you by if you aren't really aware of what's going on. It's a bit like the fight that the monarchs have for who goes into dinner first. You know, it doesn't really matter to the rest of us, but it's quite amazing how much it matters to them. Now, the Great Awakening, this is part and parcel of the 1730s and 1740s after the Glorious Revolution. There was a Protestant revival, and the importance of the Protestant revival is that it was shared between England and the 13 colonies. It was led by people like George Whitefield and John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards, but they pioneered the renewal of individual piety, and it was regarded as really important because what united them, if you like, was common reading the Bible. They were in small isolated places. It became particularly important in terms of maintaining their Anglo-American identity, which was part and parcel of the fight, if you like, to keep the French out, which is something that's still, if you like, going on with Canada. And it was also part of the importance to England, as in the building up of the British Empire. So it always had an imperialist overtone. The Great Awakening, as I've said, is really about the emphasis on prophecy, on reading the Bible, on looking for the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, and each individual being responsible for their own salvation. Now, you can see that as a settler colonialist enterprise, where it would allow people who had not got regular church meetings to encourage them to read the Bible for themselves, but it was also about really creating a sense of common identity. And when the War of Independence came along in 1776, this sense of identity was regarded as part and parcel, if you like, of the progress towards democracy, personal responsibility, and as a consequence, libertarianism, as in freedom. Now, other people have argued that really 1776 was about property itself and libertarianism and racism, because of course the colonies were dependent entirely on indentured servitude, slavery, and the racism inherent in the fact that so many of the slaves had been captured. They were part and parcel of a trading empire that had been established, run out of Britain, which obviously had moved up in the world after the Spanish and Portuguese empires, and was spending most of its time fighting France by then. So the settler colonialists were very much pro-slavery. They looked to the Bible to justify it, and they in turn, as the Vatican had done before them, denied slaves the right to read the Bible, become Christians in many cases, marry, because that would have interfered with them selling slaves. George Washington, it was said, owned more land than the George III. And there is some talk about the fact that thanks to the British Empire's reliance on Indian troops after the establishment of their Indian Empire, were quite happy to arm non-white soldiers, which was something that horrified many of the southern states, who did not like the thought of a, and this is part of why eventually America did not turn to become represented in the English Houses of Parliament, but instead turned to independence. Anyway, either way, it was regarded as relatively bloodless compared with the French Revolution, which came in 1893 and fulfilled all of the Church of England's absolute worst fears in if revolution came and if all nations got democracy and freedom, then the establishment would be over. So the second awakening was between the 1790s, post the French Revolution, and of course the horrific rise of Napoleon, who was promptly dubbed the Antichrist by many because of his overwhelming success in threatening the British Empire until about 1815. And the second Great Awakening, which I will move here, had terrified the English upper classes and middle classes in particular. It was seen as a time of tribulation, and for many they chose to turn to the Bible and look for the prophecies that would help them understand it. And what's surprising about the Great Awakening is that whereas the First Awakening had been about personal revelation, the Second Awakening in the 1820s and 30s actually involved a great many of the churches of England themselves, Church of Scotland and Church of Ireland. So, moving on to they got together in conferences, and the two conferences, or the they were a set of conferences, so these involved what I would call the rich and established. The first one is the Albury Circle. You still okay for the slides? Which took place as a week-long conference between a variety of invited people. The Albury Circle included MPs, dignitaries from the Church of England, Church of Scotland, Church of Ireland, and the main sort of popular theologians of the day. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, by the time we, they had about 4 years of meetings, but by that time they had massively disagreed and they came to a parting of the ways, and half of it moved to Ireland, where the Powers Court conferences were led by people like John Danbury, and they led to the establishment of the Plymouth Brethren. Meanwhile, Henry Drummond, who was the person who had funded the Albury conferences, led to the establishment of the Catholic Apostolic Church. Now, let's move myself on a bit. So, Edward Irving. There are still Irvingite churches, and the Albury view of the Second Coming was based on readings of the Bible and quite, you know, well-recognized theologians of that time. They saw the papacy, the Vatican, as the Antichrist. They thought that there was a 1260-year reign, which goes from the time of Constantine, Justinian the First, to the French Revolution. And they expected the apostate church, which is what they called the Church of England, Scotland and Ireland. And Irving was inspirational in persuading people that we were in a time of tribulation, and that there would be the Second Coming very soon. He was tried for heresy. He was so popular that he had people who built him 1,500 seater churches to come and listen to him, and they came and listened to him even when he was thrown out of his church as a vicar in the Church of England, and just turned up to listen to his sermons every Sunday, literally thousands of them, in the open air. He believed in spiritual gifts, including prophecy, and he saw particularly people who had prophetic dreams and ecstatic dreams as being signs that the Second Coming was soon. So this is an example of... I forgot what this church is called. It's in London. The Irvingites, as they were, it was set up in 1831. It's, what is it called? I think it's the in Bloomsbury. It was built in 1835. And the tragedy, as far as Edward Irving was concerned, was that he died on a tour of Scotland from TB in, I think, 1834. And therefore never came to see that his visions were as going to be as popular as they were. The important thing about the Irvingite churches is that they only recognized baptism, Holy Communion, and the Holy Sealing, which in their case was a second baptism where you were baptized with the Holy Spirit and it was supposed to transform you. And this is part of the original, shall we say, Christian teaching that believed in personal revelations rather than the apocalyptic end of the world of certain later Zionists. So The Catholic Apostolic Church was led afterwards by Henry Drummond, who I will move on to show you. He was a banker, he was MP twice, and he was founder of this Catholic Apostolic Church. It actually has now, when I looked it up, I think there are reckoned to be about 14 million members in America and around the world. So, or while I won't pretend I had ever heard much of it, the reality is that it has quite a significant presence, and Drummond certainly did a lot to increase it. Now, the other thing that's rather odd about the original apostles is that it included John Bates Cade, Henry Drummond, Spencer Percival, Thomas Carlyle, and Duncan Mackenzie. I believe I'm right in saying Spencer Percival is the only Prime Minister of Britain that has ever been shot, which is quite a coincidence, I'm not sure. But I rather suspect that it might have had something to do with it. Anyway, this is the Albury estate where these clerics met. And because Henry Drummond was in charge and the ownership of it, those meetings and discussions were actually published in the first place. And the Albury Circle carried on fairly strongly, but because of Irving and Drummond, it wasn't quite as popular as the Powers Court conferences, because John Darby and Irving's parted ways. Drummond had supported Irving, but John Darby continued under the patronage of Lady Theodosia Powers Court. Now, the meetings that were held at Powers Court were not published, and she actually held on to those papers, and they were sort of kept secret until the 1900s. So very few people saw about what they discussed. But Darby himself was both massively inspirational. He claimed to have set up at least 1,500 different churches. He was all over the world. He particularly got involved with the British Empire and personally was responsible for the setting up of the Plymouth Brethren. Of course, within a few years, the Plymouth Brethren had split up between the Plymouth Brethren and the Exclusive Brethren, but they became very powerful, particularly in America. And Darby is interesting because he inspired various people and was very much more influential in America. Now, I'm going to move on to, meanwhile, in America, the evangelical movement was going very strong, and this gentleman, Blackstone, William E. Blackstone, was again, we're talking about very rich people funding churches that were dedicated to the literal interpretation of the Bible. And Blackstone was very wealthy. But his view of the second coming was very much different. He was influenced by Dwight and Brooks, and particularly John Darby. Now, John Darby had this theory of what was called dispensationalism. Dispensationalism was the idea that there were two, three, sometimes seven, shall we say, ages of God's revelation to his divine plan for humanity. And when you combined it with premillennialism and the rapture, and he, particularly Blackstone, believed in the restoration of the Jews to the Holy Land. Now, this was important because at various times, various Jews, as they had gained money, independence, had ended up making the decisions either would they try and return to Jerusalem, Would they try and set up a new land of their own, like the Puritan settler colonialists had done before them in America? Or would they try and, you know, they were offered land in Kenya, I believe, and various parts of Africa if they wished to set up a homeland for themselves. Now, Blackstone convened as part of his power, convened what was called the Chicago Conferences of 1890 and 1891. And the Chicago Conference came up with the idea that the real solution to the problem was to return the Jews to the Holy Land, and that all would be well, that the second coming would happen, but the reason it hadn't happened yet and that the prophecies hadn't been fulfilled was that the Jews had not returned to the Holy Land. So they, as a bunch of very powerful businessmen, got together and decided that that would be their solution. The Blackstone Memorial was signed by, when they say prominent leaders, they do mean the sort of greatest and best of American society. So we're talking about Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Methodist and Presbyterian churches, of which Woodrow Wilson was an ardent Presbyterian, and a petition of the main, most important political and religious leaders in America. Now, part of that which is important is actually that Blackstone presented a Bible to Herzl, who was in the process of leading the Zionist movement, which, if you've read much by Tony Greenstein historically, Herzl's ideas originally were to look at, you know, where could the Zionists safely set up their own Zion or Israel. And he presented him with a Bible with all of the prophecies underlined in red to say, under no circumstances should the Jews return to any land other than the Middle East and the original Palestine, which of course has consequences for today. But the Blackstone petition, there were two, one in 1891 and another one in 1916, which of course was going to greatly influence the League of Nations later on, and he supported the Balfour Declaration. Now, sorry, there we go. Enter Cyrus, I forgot what his second name is, I. Schofield. Now, Schofield had an exceedingly colourful life. He was born in Michigan to an Episcopalian family. His roots were Puritan. He served on the Union side in the American Civil War. He married. He had two daughters. He used his, I believe it's Catholic wife's connections to become a lawyer. He pursued a political career as a Kansas senator. One of the youngest in the country's history, but he was forced to resign for fraud, particularly embezzling political funds, taking bribes, forging checks. He promptly abandoned his wife and daughters, who divorced him for desertion, and decamped to St. Louis. He worked with the then influential evangelist Dwight L. Moody and married his second wife after his divorce. Now, he converted to evangelical Christianity. He was ordained a Congregationalist in 1883 and was highly successful. He expanded the membership of his church, as Irving had done before him. And there's a lot of influence, a lot of suggestions that he was influenced by John Danbury's dispensationalism, and that he used a lot of his theological knowledge to write his reference Bible and study literature. There's also quite a lot of suggestions that he met certain prominent Jewish Zionists, Untermeyer has been suggested, who funded and provided the contacts to get his reference Bible published by the Oxford University Press, who made it an exceedingly respectable Bible. And in that, it wasn't that they printed the King James Bible, KJV as it's often abbreviated to. But what he did, which had not been done before, was to print it with notes on every single page. Sometimes the notes are actually more than the verses in the Bible, and it had specific reference notes to tell people how they should interpret the verses of the Bible, which obviously was very popular with people who wanted to study it on their own, but also chains of reference, which are the linking up of different verses from Old and New Testament to portray a vision of the Bible as a simple, single narrative that was leading to the establishment of Israel and the consistency of narrative that they were putting forward. It was used as a text for the various theological colleges that were set up to train more. And as a consequence of that, Oxford University Press, I read, I don't know how true it is, that Oxford University Press found that during the Great Depression of the 1930s, or 20s and 30s, that it was actually a lifesaver for them for keeping their book, you know, keeping them, their books from going under, because it had sold more than 3 million copies. And to date, I believe it's sold at least 10 million copies. So, and the evangelical Christians that use it, it's obviously it's not as reprinted as the Gideon Bible, but neither is it given away. It was disingenuous in the fact that the commentaries distorted many of the interpretations of the Bible, sometimes implying things that were not really true, but always suggesting that the Scofield interpretation was just as authoritative as the Bible teachings that had been that had gone before. So this is Mr. Scofield. Now, vocabulary. Obviously, the teachings that they were doing were very specific, and they used words in very particular ways. So millennialism is, as you might guess, the thousand-year period. And it was used in various ways. Sometimes they would look at the biblical prophecies and suggest that, you know, there were that this is how they did their calculations for. I mentioned the 1260 years that was the time period between Constantinople as the head of the church and the 1789 French Revolution. But there were numerous ways in which numbers were treated as interchangeable. So it would see that a week, you know, there were quotes in the Bible, you know, but really it's about those interpretations and how they fitted in with the prophecies that people wanted to see. Eschatological is to any writings that are to do with the Day of Judgment and the expectation that that is going to be either on death, or it is more likely that it is going to be a end of days, so you will be in some sort of purgatory for the rest for your life until the second coming, which is why very many people see the second coming as being existentially important to their hope of going to heaven or hell for the rest of eternity. The tribulations are, and you will see this even in things like people commenting, I've seen it in comments on YouTube videos, on Twitter, all sorts of places. Times of tribulation, it's a time of destruction, but people take it personally. Either it's going to foretell the second coming, or it is an expectation that, you know, things are always getting worse. It was always better in the old days, and every time that something happens. If you listen carefully to the death of Charlie Kirk, you will see people talking about it as if it is that. The second coming usually in Christian terms refers to the return of Jesus. But for the Jewish Messiah, it would be the first, because as far as they're concerned, there have been a number of people who've claimed to be the Messiah. They don't recognize Jesus as one of those, but Simon Bar Kokhba, who led the final fight against the Roman Empire in AD 133 to 136, which led to the expulsion of the Jews from from Israel, and the renaming of Judea as Palestine, happened in AD 136. And there was another Messiah, I believe his name is Sabbatai Levi, in the 1600s, who many Jews had believed would be the new Messiah. Unfortunately, he went to turn up in Jerusalem, and the caliph put him under arrest and persuaded him to convert to Islam, which did not go down well with those people who were expecting there to be some sort of miracle. Now, the dispensations, they're not dispensations as in we might look at permissions. They're periods of time defined by God's plan for mankind. Now, different theologians for the different ideas have variously decided it might be 3 or it might be 4. It could be up to 7. And in this, according to the Scofield Bible, we are in the 7th dispensation, i.e. the final plan. And the important thing about that is that these concepts have become increasingly influential. So, in the 20th century, the American Christian Palestine Committee, which you might be forgiven for thinking was something to do with Palestine, when in actual fact it's really about the importance of establishing the state of Israel. J. Frank Norris was a fundamentalist Baptist who lobbied Truman to get this state of Israel recognized. Martin Luther King Jr. was a supporter during his early years, and very influential until he realized that it was unlikely to provide any real change. Jerry Falwell was led the Southern Baptist Church, who were also supportive, but in the 20th century, people like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush were part and parcel of the support Israel under any circumstances, and Pat Robinson, who I don't know how many people are, I don't know how cognizant everyone is, but he was a massively, he was a prominent televangelist. He followed Falwell as a key figure in the religious right during the 1990s, and he used his Christian broadcasting network to advance Christian Zionist perspectives. It is not simply that these people are Christian ideologues, it's that they are massively important, obviously, to presidents. There are various presidents who have been involved in supporting the, shall we say, unconditional support of Israel. Now, moving on to the present, John Hagee, who is the Christians United for Israel, and Mike Huckabee. I'm hoping some of you will recognize these. He's the current UN ambassador. Pete Hegseth, who is Secretary for Defense. This is just in Trump's cabinet. Elise Stefanik, who is the UN ambassador, who I believe didn't cover herself with glory for denying the genocide. Mike Pence, who is VP or Vice President. And obviously Charlie Kirk, who was very much leader of Turning Point and responsible for persuading a great many of the... What we most people don't realize today is that the younger generation of Americans in particular are very much more, shall we say, socialist, socially conservative, and much more religious than the children and grandchildren of the swinging 60s you might expect. Now, what I was going to suggest is that I can't minimize this. So, let's see. If I look at, I can't, can I see Zoom? There we go. No, I can't. I can't see. So, Paul, can I stop? Oh, there we are. Can I stop there and ask if there is any in the chat questions, or would you like me to carry on and talk a little bit more about how the Scofield Bible has, shall we say, poisoned or skewed people's understanding of what the Bible means in terms of Christianity?
Okay, comrades, if there are any questions for now, could you indicate now? If there are not, then I suggest you can carry on and then we have questions and discussion. So if there are any comments now, please could you indicate? Okay, Susan, carry on.
Oh dear, I was hoping that you would be tired of the sound of my voice by now, but never mind. We can hope. So, okay. So what are we looking at? Yeah? Right, can everyone see? Now, these ones I have, this was me. I thought, you know, I can't read the whole of the Scofield Bible. And there are two versions. And this is where I say that there has been quite massive Jewish Zionist involvement, not just in the funding of the Scofield Bible, but also in the but also in the fact that the new Scofield Bible, which was written after 1967, is nothing like as popular. Needless to say, 1967 happens to coincide with the 1967 Six-Day War. But since the 2000s, a lot of people have returned to the 1909 version that was originally published. So, the dispensationalism. Their system of history divides history into different periods or dispensations, each characterized by a distinct revelation of God's will and specific human tests. Scofield identified 8 such dispensations, and he identified them as innocence, conscience, human government, promise, law, grace, kingdom, and eternity, with obviously the new, the coming, shall we say, world domination by Israel, as the belief that there would be a you know, kingdom of God that would be established. Now, course principle of dispensationalism, as presented in the Scofield Bible, is this sharp distinction between the people of Israel and the church, as in the church which was those Christians who were part and parcel of it. The literal interpretation of prophecy adapts this, shall we say, woodenly literal approach to all biblical prophecies. So all the Old Testament promises made to Israel.
Can I just double check?
Yeah.
On the slide.
Oh, can you not
on
see?
On the slide, we're on 20 of 27.
Yes, we are. These ones
there,
are relative. Oh, sorry, I've jumped, have I?
No, I think. Yeah, I think your talk jumped on from the slide, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Because the last thing we could see on the slide, or I can see,
was
is
this
the
one.
Last name of Charlie Kirk.
Yes, yeah.
So you need to, I think you need to move
right.
On the slide.
Yes, that's right, it does, it jumps, you're quite right. So, these ones are slightly there. But anyway, so the point is, by reading the Scofield Bible, the way that it is presented makes it look as if dispensationalism is the only way you can interpret the Bible, that the Bible is not the way that it is taught, shall we say, in the Catholic Church or the Church of England or any of the other churches, and this is the only interpretation that it can be. And the core principle is that there is a distinction between the people of Israel and the church and its literal prophecies. Okay? So everything to do with the Scofield Bible's dispensational framework aligns with premillennialism, which is the belief that there will be a 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth and a pre-tribulation rapture. So they think that the church will be raptured. That is to say, Mary MacDonald was a prophetess in the 1820s to 40s who thought that, having read a small portion of, I think it's the book of Elijah, that every single righteous Christian would be gathered up by some sort of miracle and kept in waiting in a equivalent of heaven while they waited for the Jews who would, how can we say, to convert to Christianity. Yes? Its impact on evangelical thought was widespread and influential, and it helped to popularize these ideas within the fundamentalist and evangelical Christianity of the United States, so much so that you will get people like Pete Hegseth pronouncing that, you know, whatever Israel does, whether it's ethnic cleansing or genocide, then that's in the Bible, it's there, and we just have to accept it because this is the work of God. And, you know, human rights and all the rest of it do not come into it. Scofield created the reference Bible specifically, it appears, in order to impose his authority, but particularly his view of what Christianity was. Yeah? As the only, but also the God-given authority. And this is part of it. It's the controversy is that these are people who regard only their interpretation of the Bible as the only one that is right, and that their beliefs are the only ones that are important. That God has a plan, a special plan, and a separate plan for the Jewish people than the ones for the Christian church, and that theirs is the only interpretation. The other thing is that with the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, they regard the covenant of Abraham and the restoration of the Jewish people to Israel as confirmation of the prophecies that they are claiming that have been fulfilled, and that therefore justify the fact that only their interpretations of the prophecies to come are the only ones that can be expected. Now, the dispensationalist theology treats God's covenant with Abraham as literal. It's an eternal promise that remains as valid today as it was. Until Vatican II, which is in 1965-7, the church, both the Catholic Church and various other churches, had taught what was called the replacement theology, which suggests that the New Testament Christianity had replaced Israel as God's chosen people. Dispensationalism asserts that God's promises are eternal, that they cannot be rescinded, and that therefore Israel will always have a place in the prophecies of the Bible, and they will be every bit as fulfilled as any that are fulfilled for Christianity. Now, Vatican II has sort of gone against that. Between 1870, which was when Vatican I was established, the Pope regarded himself, I presume, I don't know if everyone knows, but the Pope was regarded as the only official authority, and it was his word that was law. I'll say a bit more about that later on. But the end times, Scofield's interpretation of the Old Testament and the prophets, and particularly the books of Revelation. Don't forget I'd said about the chain of causality. So a lot of these are things that were linked together. The book of Revelation was going to outline the specific timetable for the end times. So people were sort of roused up to a belief that every time they could latch on to one thing, like the establishment of the State of Israel, or Israel as the undefeated nation who were showing that they were the proof of God's promise for Christians, was that Israel, the new Israel, was given everything it needed by way of protection, and particularly obviously the 67 war, where, you know, the defeat of their enemies within 6 days was pushed as a very biblical amount of time. I won't say anything about the extent to which the Israelis provoked that when long before the combined forces were ready, and as a consequence the defeat of the various Arab nations was made extremely easy. But we won't go there. But the formation of the state, the return of the Jews to their homeland, they were all regarded as these direct fulfillments. Now, the other thing that I was looking at was the relationship between Israel and the new churches. As I said, the Vatican argued that Christianity, or at least Christians in general, regarded the covenant with Abraham as applying to them just as much as it had because of the apostolic succession. When the Reformation challenged that and said, well, apostolic succession doesn't really matter that much. It's really about Christians achieving the same sort of personal revelation of God that Christ had. This was accepted, whereas Scofield's interpretation suggests that God has a separate plan for the ethnic Israelites, and this therefore means that the state of Israel has to exist in order for Christians see the second coming. And this is why, having supported Israel, they now can't let go of it. Genesis. Now, the two things that will get very heavily commented on, and I'm only going to do these last two. It gets quoted a lot. I've certainly seen it quoted by Pete Hegseth, and I've seen it quoted by Huckabee. You will actually see it quoted on TV programs if you listen very much to a lot of the discussions, particularly on things like, Israel isn't guilty of genocide. And it's the Genesis verse, chapter 12, verse 3, that says, I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee. It's central to Christian Zionism because it is interpreted that all nations and individuals will be judged on their treatment of Jewish people. This is why the allegations of anti-Semitism are so devastating for very many people, and why it becomes such an important part of the whole ethos. Now, people like John Hagee use this verb to argue that there has to be unconditional support, and that anyone who opposes, or shall we say, like the Yemeni who are bombing Israel, or anyone who speaks against it, is expecting to be cursed, and should be cursed, and should be treated as the enemy. And the other one is, and so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written. This is Romans 11:26. There shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn every ungodliness away from Jacob. Now, Scofield's interpretation of this is that all Israel is interpreted literally as the whole of the Jewish people, and not as the spiritual body of Christians, as in the Christian church. The prophecy is understood to mean that the Jewish people will eventually return to the Holy Land, and for Christians, that the Jews will accept Jesus as their Messiah, and they will be restored to their original place. Now, Zionist application, this literal national restoration of the Jewish people is entirely embedded in, it is the responsibility of all Christian nations to support the Jewish people in the Jewish state. And this is where the unconditional support for the Jewish people supporting genocide and ethnic cleansing becomes so concerning. Anyway, enough from me. I hope you have found it at least interesting, or at least that you have acquired some new knowledge and some understanding about how we have got to the mess that we are in at the moment. Okay, right. Can I stop sharing? She says. Hopefully. Where are we? You all sound a bit shell-shocked. I'm very sorry. I haven't done these for a long time. I'm used to. Can I stop the share? Stop share. There we go.
Yeah.
Okay. That'll teach you to invite me to give you a discussion. Anyway, right. I'm going to disappear.
Okay.
Right. Yes, so comments. The last thing the Vatican would have wanted was individuals and groups being able to read the Bible. Certainly the Vatican regarded it as that the clergy should be responsible for reading the Bible, and it should be the clergy who are responsible for imparting the Bible's teachings to their congregation and admonishing them or whatever. And in many ways that continues. What's interesting about the apostolic churches, and certainly the churches of the Reformation, was that, and the Methodism was another one, but Congregationalism, it was very much seen as every man, or woman for that matter, but certainly every man should be their own teacher, their own priest, their own belief, responsible for their own spiritual guidance, and not with the help of the Bible, and not reliant on just the teaching and interpretation of an official clergy. Don't know about the Amish. I'm not trying to pretend that I know as much about that. Wikipedia, Church of Christ the King. That's the Bloomsbury Church. Yes, that's right. But you can see, for that church to be built in a couple of years, I mean, it is an absolutely massive church, and it held 1,500 people. That was enough. That was because the congregation who wanted, that was, you know, it was literally, you know, a 3-hour sermon to a packed house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. I think Paul, we lost Paul for a bit, but he's back now.
All right. Sorry.
Apologies. I had to reboot my system.
All right.
My screen went completely blank and started flickering. Right. So,
Simon, Mark, and Diana. And Jonathan and Paul and Ian. So have I covered any, have I answered any of the questions that you might have wanted to know about why it is that the Christian Zionists in America seem to believe something that is so, as far as I'm concerned, alien to what, you know, the religious belief of my own parents grew up with. Yes, Jonathan.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it was an interesting talk, but I don't see where you fitted historical materialism in. I don't really... You mentioned the feudal... You didn't mention the feudal mode. I can't remember you mentioning the feudal mode of production or the capitalist mode of production was variants, and, you know, how that fits in. I really, you know, I didn't see an historical materialist.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I did find it. And the other thing I wanted to say, but which is not to do with it, you did mention it, and I'd like to talk to you about it sometime, is this thing of individual salvation.
Yes.
I mean, it's not connected with the Zionism thing, but... You know, it's connected with individualism, which I'm interested in. But I'll ask you that about another time, because that's not really the meeting.
Okay. The feudalism comes in with the fact that these churches are so powerful because they tithe. So in addition to all the taxes and other things that you're paying 10% of your income to the church, which if you can increase your congregation from half a dozen believers to 1,500 in by way of presenting these exciting, for want of a better word, sermons, and you run theological colleges, you are collecting money for people who want to study, then obviously you are talking about literally hundreds of millions of dollars now. But even at the time, you were talking about rich and influential people, bankers, financiers who were attracted to it, but also ordinary people who were funding that. You can see it even in the cults that have arisen, you know, in the 1900s and 2000s, cults that acquire vast amounts of money. Yeah, and it's the money that translates into power and particularly political power in the 20th century. Okay, Jonathan?
Yeah.
But I didn't try and emphasize that too much because I think it's about respecting the believers and the belief, because without the belief, the money wouldn't be following on. Mm. Yeah? Sorry, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, actually, on the question of historical materialism, I mean, it's quite a complex relationship between the various churches and the various social systems. For instance, the Catholic Church is basically the sort of the spiritual, long-standing spiritual expression of feudalism, going right back to the founding of, right back to the period where the Catholic Church began to take shape. It was taking shape more or less at the same time as the Roman Empire was giving way to the more natural economy of feudalism, and it became the chief ideological expression of it for several hundred years, I think. The Reformation, on the other hand, was the beginnings of the stirrings of capitalism within the within bourgeois, within feudal society.
I've got some more insights on that if you're interested.
Yeah, let me carry on a bit. I mean, that's my understanding of it. And in fact, the Puritanism was a serious ideological expression of the English Revolution. Protestantism, a slightly different type, rebelling against the rule of the Catholic Church, played an important role before the English Revolution in Holland. On the other hand, it didn't really play much of a role in the French Revolution, because the French Revolution was more secular, consciously secular than anything that happened before that. So I think that was an expression of the more advanced nature of the politics of the French Revolution. But I do think that evangelical Christianity and the like, really, I mean, there is a Jewish element, and I know how there are certain people who don't like this observation made by a number of people, that there is a change in the theology that tends to regard the Old Testament and the Jewish elements in the Old Testament as being brought into and partly negating some of the insights in the New Testament that are considered to have transcended Judaism by the Catholic Church. And there was a certain change in the Protestants, some of the Protestant theology that evolved after the Reformation, to incorporate that, including on the questions of money and things like that, and enterprise and whatever, which are seen as in some ways more licensed by some Old Testament interpretations than what's in the New Testament. I'm speaking very generally, of course. I can't remember. I've read this stuff, but I can't remember it in detail. It's quite a long time ago. I think in terms of Zionism, I think that this is part of the background of it. I don't think it played a decisive role, but it certainly provided an ideological milieu in which this stuff could take root. In which Jewish Zionism could actually become, actually gain traction, in the 19th century. I think on its own, I don't think it's even true that Christian Zionism simply emerged in the 1820s, because there's always been an element of fetishism of the Jewish question and Jews in Christianity anyway, including anti-Semitic elements. There's an obsession with the Jews because Christianity is relieved, rightly or wrongly, to be a schism of Judaism. I don't think that's strictly true. I think it's slightly more complicated than that, because rabbinical Judaism, the Judaism we know, actually dates from slightly later than even the emergence of Christianity, about 200 years, 200 or so BC, AD rather, or BC, CE, or whatever you call it. It is slightly later, and the what they call the original religion, where Christianity came from, is not necessarily the same thing as rabbinical Judaism, but
okay. Let me just make a couple of other points
very briefly. I do think that it provided the ideological background in which this could take root, but I don't think it's played a primary role. I think it's very clear that you cannot have Zionism as an operative program unless you have people willing to do the business and actually take over Palestine. And that didn't really crystallize until towards the end of the 19th century. And I think that happened for different reasons, not because of the autonomous developments of theology, but simply because the opportunity arose for a Jewish element of the bourgeoisie that aspired to join in the huge colonial drives that were going on in the last 20 odd years of the 19th century, and saw a possibility of actually putting this into practice. And that is the relevance of Rhodes, of Herzl's idealization of Rhodes. He's basically saw, yes, we could do the same thing, you know, as Rose is doing. And we are, you know, we're part of the wealthy elements of Western society. Why can't we get a cut? And I think that's the genesis of real Zionism, of a real movement. And of course, it has its background with the persecution of the Jews in medieval period, and the beginnings of the persecution, the beginnings of a recrudescence of that in the late 19th century. They more or less happened simultaneously. You know, the growth of racial anti-Semitism more or less emerged at the same time as Zionism, as far as I can see. Political, you know, Zionism as a real movement, anyway, as opposed to a religious concept. But it does explain a lot, on the other hand, about the United States and the huge support that it does have in the United States, particularly now. People like that ambassador guy, what's his name? Huckabee, you know, he's an extreme example of Christian Zionist influence. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Okay. On the one hand, if I come in on that point, on the one hand, incidentally, some of those individuals or the text may not seem that influential from a material point of view, but ultimately, some of those individuals involved and the text that they use to justify it does become a sphere of influence. So I think possibly Conrad Ear might be understating the role that some of the individuals and the tech that they use to justify. I think there might be an underestimation, but that I just wanted to make that point. Okay. Susan, do you want to carry on?
Yeah. Okay, rabbinical, the Sadducees and the Essenes were very well established in the 100 or more years before the birth of Christ. So, and Zionism was very much associated with, the Sadducees were the people who were interested in making peace with the Romans as the new power, just as they had been with the Hellenistic period, the Seleucid Empire post Alexander the Great. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were teaching a more spiritual version of Judaism, which was the one that ultimately survived after the destruction of the temple, which I did mention. Mm-hmm. The Essenes, on the other hand, withdrew from, if you like, they just did not believe in the temple worship at all. And there was a lot of discussion about whether or not they were the ones who had inspired Christianity. Now, Christianity, particularly as it evolved over the next 300 years from the death of Christ until Constantine's, the Nicene convention, Constantine called it basically after 10-20 years of civil war and used it to prop up the Roman Empire. And it was, if you like, an unholy alliance or a holy alliance between those Christians under, I think it's Bishop Ananias, who was felt threatened by feeling the Arian and other interpretations. There were dozens of different churches. Each church had their own things. They had their own specific gospels. They had their own ideas. There's the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary. There are dozens of them. The Dead Sea Scrolls has got only a sample of them. I read Robert Graves' translations of the Oxyrhynchus Papyri, which is this huge Christian dump of Christian and early translations, which talk about dozens and dozens of different churches. There were no heretics until the Nicene Creed established a pro forma, a specific organize, you know, recognition of this is the only sort of Christianity. And Jerome translated the Bible, and that was the interpretation of the Christian works as they were seen. And it was done to embed this hierarchical, powerful state religion, which was Christianity. Constantine himself established, you know, December the 25th as the birth of Christ, because there was a Sol Invictus celebration on December the 25th. The Western Orthodox Church celebrates the birth of Christ on January the 6th, because they do not see this too. You know, we are all together, shall we say, bamboozled by the idea that everything in the Bible has to be absolutely correct, that there are no other versions, and that the whole point about, yes, you're right, the Protestant Reformation was a complete revolution against what the church had become, which was a oppressive and strictly hierarchical organization, which was only interested in power and money. Now, people like Jacob Fugger had funded the wars that devastated, as I said, France particularly. Any of these religious groups, which were still, you know, oral transmission, that is word of mouth transmission of what real Christianity meant, as in its poverty, its love, its concern for the kindness and the well-being of individuals, as opposed to the pomp, the circumstance, the maintenance of the status quo that the Catholic Church for that thousand and more years had instituted. And that, and you know, the whole point of the Protestant Reformation was an attempt to get back to what they saw as the original Christianity. Of course they couldn't, because, you know, under Constantine and under the Church Fathers for that next, and in particular Jerome, they had actually destroyed, rewritten, mistranslated and done whatever they wanted to change Christian theology to suit the politics of the time. But I didn't want to get involved in, you know, trying to tell you what was my interpretation of it, but I wanted to present you with the facts of the history so that you could follow it through if you wished to. Now, the whole point about the why did Martin Luther's, 95 theses that were hammered on the door of the church were entirely about this: we can't go on with the debt and usury. Usury had been banned until the Pope decided that he needed more money for more wars. You know, that's the same familiar story, whether it's, you know, the President of the United States suddenly demanding huge amounts of money and payments for weapons, or turning on his friends, as in the church in the Third Crusade, turning on not Jerusalem to fight the Muslims who had taken over Jerusalem, but the Christians in Constantinople who were a threat to his power, or the Albigenses or the Cathars or the Knights Templar who were a threat to his power in France. And as you say, France after the oppression that was that total devastation. They burned 30,000 Knights Templar and their families and their children alive in order to impress upon everybody else, to intimidate them into not believing all this so-called Cathar nonsense, you know, and it never went away. They fled because Europe is a landmass, with the exception of, you know, England on the tail end of it. But the whole point was these, you couldn't suppress the stories entirely, and you couldn't suppress the fact that, yeah, Jesus's original messages appear to have been ones of spiritual and personal life as a more, as less materialist and more community minded. Okay, so yes, there was that, but I'm not trying to show you how I think people saw it. I'm trying to show you the facts as they, and trace the different things that have happened. And the influential people that I've mentioned, these are the people who succeeded in getting their message across, which is the one that has now survived. And the so-called Bible is an important part of that, just as Tyndale's Bible, translating the Bible. Now, what was the first thing that happened to Tyndale's Bible? It took out all of the bishops. It turned into congregations and elders of the church. There were no priests. It was a much more egalitarian church that he was trying to create for people to see this as this was what early Christianity and the New Testament was about. And it was promptly rewritten by King James's Conference of Bishops, who put all of the hierarchy back in. So 85% or so of the New Testament is Tyndale's Bible, and the 15% that isn't is all the stuff that got shoved back in order to maintain the Church of England as a successor to the Church of Rome. Okay? And that rewriting of the Bible and its theological importance, and its, more importantly, its political framework, reinforcing the state. And that's what I talked about, slavery. When slavery was acceptable, the church was on their side. When it was no longer acceptable, suddenly abolitionism, it became something different, because the church has always modified its theology to fit in with the needs of the state that it serves. Yeah. Anyway, now what else did you want to talk about? I'd said mentioned Jacob Fugger. He was the person who was one of the richest. He was in, when he died in the 15th century. He lent money, and he didn't just charge interest as a usurer. He actually took collateral, so he ended up, I think they reckon he was worth about 400 billion and he was the richest man in Europe. And funded most of the wars, but he basically, the church, in order to pay the interest that he demanded on the money he'd lent the church, allowed the simony, you know, the indulgences, the sale of indulgences, that led to the sort of final straw for Martin Luther. Mm. Anyway, go on, Paul.
I suppose there's from that point of view, I suppose there's a sort of materialist element, because it's no coincidence that at some point or another, bishops and so on, they all got together to establish which books actually made the Bible. And as you know, there's a whole host of books that never actually made it into the Bible. That's not an accident, is it?
No.
They tell you it's all about interpretation, and they believe that certain events didn't happen. But the thing that struck me is that obviously evangelicalism gets a bad name, but there were people out there at one point that actually used their evangelicalism, allegedly, for the cause of the working class, and I'm thinking of Methodists and the Talbot and Martyrs, and the fact that they were heavily involved in the trade union movement.
That's why I was talking about Methodism and John Wesley and the First Awakening, which was this, the intention of that revivalist movement to bring, as they saw it, true Christianity to the working people, rather than this emphasis on, you know, the great and the good that church was for showing off. It was for, you know, the rich people to be at the front and the poor people to be standing at the back. It was all about showing off and how much material wealth that you'd got.
Would recommend a film called Comrade if nobody's seen it. And that was about the formation of the Talbot and Martyrs and how the people behind it were sent to transportation in Australia. Mm-hmm. And they eventually ended up in Canada, and they I think I've got I can't remember what it's called, but I've actually got one of their autobiographies. So I just wanted to put that in there. But I find it really pernicious, the fact that when people start to read the Bible, and if they really want to get really deep into it, they buy these commentaries, and which you can purchase. But then you or I may not realise the political significance behind these commentaries. So people are using this stuff to help them interpret the Bible. And in fact, a lot of it is really quite pernicious.
Yeah. I mean, the examples I would give you are the Vatican had its hands on, controlled every single archaeological dig from the, 1800s, when Napoleon Bonaparte had gone to Egypt and then through to the Germans when they came into Jerusalem. They actually knocked down the wall of part of the wall of Jerusalem in order for the German emperor, what's his name, Frederick II, to ride his horse through the streets of Jerusalem on a white stallion, as he saw it, in the late 1890s. I've actually seen some of the film of it. We live in an age when there is film as well as,
yeah, I know, was as well as writing. Quakers.
On the one hand, Quakers are important because they are part and parcel of the Protestant. They are perfectly well rooted in what, as far as I can see, is the Christian, early Christian ethic. It's much more egalitarian. But it still separates men and women. These are people trying to recreate. The real problem, as far as I can see, is that because the church was so powerful after 325 and the Nicosia conference, that the Christians who are trying to get in touch with the original, Christ's teachings and the original Christians as they were in that first century CE, cannot do it through the Bible as it is. But what has turned up are things like the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are things like that. There are increasing documentation. So in a horrible way, what they were looking for, it's a matter of time, that time has allowed us. But you can still see when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in, I think, 1954, they haven't, they weren't translated for more than 50 years. The Vatican and various scholars sat on it. It is a point that's been pointed out is the various interpretations of other archaeological descriptions, other codexes and documents that have been found that quite categorically prove that, you know, some or possibly all of Paul's epistles are a fake, that the, you know, even the Hebrew Bible wasn't found as documentary, you know, as attested by independent documentary evidence before 300 BCE. There is no documentation that an awful lot of these stories quite clearly show evidence that they were pinched from other religious groups, that there are other religions whose stories were very similar. Sometimes the Hebrew Bible turns the interpretation upside down because they didn't like it. Sometimes they just simply transposed it from, you know, before to after. Sometimes they took the whole things wholesale and just simply, you know, they you know, in the early church and sometimes even in the Roman church, they've put a lot more emphasis on the Greek philosophers, you know, Socrates and Plato and others. There's far more influence of those than you would think during the Hellenistic period. And then it got written out again when it became obvious that Greek and Hebrew scholars were starting to draw conclusions. You know, part of the reason why I didn't mention Spinoza, but part of the reason why he's so was so complicated is some of these people in the middle, you know, the late Middle Ages, the, you know, the Age of Enlightenment, are so powerful, or so, you know, because their intellect and they were Renaissance people. They could they collected lots of different subjects. Nowadays we have people who are, you know, outstanding in their own field, but these people were people who united lots of different things and put things together. And they are increasingly, you know, the last 25, I've been following the evolution of religions, how they change at the historically, and how much knowledge, there is so much more knowledge in the hands of people who study the theology of it and how it has changed and how people have used it. One of the things that YouTube video that I'd said was talking about the Nicaea conference and saying, this is an example. This was the playbook that every conference since has used, and it includes including the Labour conference now, is you and will be your party. You micromanage how the conference is put together. You set the agenda. You choose the people who are going to be invited. You make sure that they only discuss the topics that you find acceptable so that you can maneuver how people then make that decision. And then you manufacture consent. And if you study the Nicaea conference, that is exactly how Constantine did it, from putting the church fathers up, from removing people who were not going to follow his agenda, and basically just psychological pressure to come out with the result that he wanted, which was an agreeable state religion which would for once and for all unite a rising church that was interested in power and the ability to get rid of all of its rivals by declaring them heretics. And if you like, Christianity has lost ever since. And whether I don't know whether you see it as that, but whether Protestantism or is on the one hand trying to reclaim that, and on the other hand is going down a really quite dangerous path in supporting the worst elements of, and I don't think it's got anything to do with Jesus Christ, but the worst elements of Old Testament Zionist teachings. in what is basically an apocalyptic end of days world domination by Israel, which would have started out where they were only interested in creating a state of Israel that would be a theocracy run for Jews by Jews, that would be their state and was only for them, which has now turned into some sort of globalist New World Order agenda. And that is, I don't know whether that's true or whether that's just another interpretation of it. Maybe in the future, if, as I suspect, Israel does not maintain its invincibility, they may rearrange and recreate the post-destruction of the Second Temple and the diaspora that they were before. There is now suggestions that actually 80% of Jews didn't live in Israel. They were never, they were always part and parcel of a diaspora. They were quite happy, and that the biggest problem that Israel has at the moment is the Jews who don't want to go home and who don't want to be next year in Jerusalem, that they would rather be where they are and continue in their own interpretations of how they want to live according to their interpretation, which is why, you know, people forget Judaism, like Christianity, is not a monolith. It is not one, you know, it is many churches and many different interpretations. And the same is true of Islam, of course.
Diana?
Yeah, I've got a question which possibly goes too far back in time for the topic being discussed. But what I'm interested in is how human societies degenerated from egalitarian setup to patriarchy and misogyny, and how that relates to the time in which if it does relate at all, which I think it probably does, when Judaism first appeared as a religion, as it was first evolved from sort of more ancient beliefs, such as the sort of animism, paganism, which some of the indigenous societies that are still existing that haven't been wiped out yet have.
Yeah, I can tell you, not so much what I think, but certainly what the consensus is to be of the stuff that I've been researching, which is that it basically comes with monotheism. Paganism in all of its forms is either every Egyptian deity is both male and female. That's why there are so many twins. There are so many brothers married to sisters. There are so many gods where there are, you know, every different aspect of life has a male and a female god and goddess. So, you know, part of creation, if you like, is this. Sometimes they're even hermaphrodite, sometimes they are, but the recognition is that there are both. Yes, whereas with Zoroastrianism, which may or may not be, you know, it's the first sort of big monotheistic religion, you end up with, if you only have one god. And it becomes, you know, early religions didn't seem to have that problem with mother religions, yes, with matriarchal religions, but they have been so systematically wiped out that it's very difficult to know whether or not there was ever a matriarchal, monotheistic religion, but certainly the Earth Mother and Sky Father, or vice versa, are fundamental to most. But the real problem comes with, and I came across an interesting book which I've never managed to track down, which basically says there is a problem with writing. When religions are word of mouth and oral, then everybody is part and parcel of it. Then the shamanistic religions, it's not linked, you know, it's not limited to one sex. It's limited to people who feel the calling and the need. Whereas the problem with writing is that there is a condition in which people try and acquire authority by ascribing their words and thoughts. You know, it's the Big Brother bit that says, you know, I'm going to project my antipathy, my racism, my sexism, whatever, and my Big Brother God will back me up in believing that these people are bad and those people good. And on the one hand, it sounds so simplistic that it's just downright silly, but on the other hand, you look at Jerome translating the Vulgate Bible and deciding that, no, it wasn't Adam and Eve who were guilty for original sin. It was Eve. Yes, it's all her fault. She's the only one in the garden. She's the one who did it. And even though he was translating from the Greek into Latin, yes, it didn't bother him at all that he might, you know, I'm sure, would he have cared about the next 1600 years of women being told in every damn, you know, sermon that there was, that it was women's fault, that they were the ones who tempted Adam and that therefore they are the ones responsible for original sin? I don't know. Maybe he would have just enjoyed the fact that they were going to be punished because he didn't like them. I don't know. But I do know that writing seems to have an authority that word of mouth doesn't. Yeah, that if people have read it in a book, that if it is on the printed page, that there is something about the fact that people will read it and assume that it somehow has more authority than just simply being told it. Yeah, but that's the best I can tell you about where it started 2,000-3,000 years ago. And it's obvious that before then, there is not the same. You know, we are reinventing it. It's like the people who think that lions only exist in prides, you know, that whereas if you've actually followed lions, you know damn well that female lions are the ones who do all the hunting and male lions end up with all the food, because otherwise all the female lions would lose all their cubs every time they got a new strongest male. Yeah.
Ian and then Dino again.
Well, just briefly, just on the question of this sort of ascribing to Eve the blame for everything that supposedly happened in the Garden of Eden or whatever, strikes me that the revisions of such things always invariably have a material reason behind them, and it's not so much that the practice in the world changes because the theology changes. It's usually the other way around. The theology changes to reflect some social interest that has dictated the necessity to change the ideology that's in circulation at the time. So I think the real thing that you have to investigate is not so much the ideology at a superficial level, but what's going on behind it. Now, I'm just, you know, so I don't know in great detail. I'm not sure that many other people do. But there is material in Engels that sort of in The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, which does go through some of the actual, obviously limited by the research that was available when Engels wrote it in the sort of mid to late 19th century, but nevertheless, that goes through the material that was known at the time about the early evolution of humanity and the end of primitive communism, the beginning of the separation of society into classes, etc. And I think it's worth studying that and perhaps some more up to date research on related topics than if you see what I mean. Simply the idea.
There has been some newer research shows that whereas the Romans, particularly in the imperial stage, so we're talking about the Roman Empire from Julius Caesar and Augustus mm-hmm. onwards. That the Roman Senate was very, the Roman Empire itself was very much male dominated. Mm-hmm. But the Etruscan mm-hmm. Empire, which had come before it, and the Etruscan kings were very much, females were allowed to, were part and parcel of the political landscape. They attended functions together. They were not separated out. They were not expected, there are various Roman writings that, complain about how Etruscan women got drunk at parties instead of behaving themselves, that they spoke up in things. You have to know that for Paul to say women should shut up in church, that it's perfectly obvious that women weren't shutting up in church. That Paul saying men shouldn't be taught by women is because the ancient world had women who were teachers. It has become an understood thing that if there is a polemic against it, you must know that people did it. And that's why you have to have a law against it. That's why you have to tell people not to do it. And it is the people afterwards. So, yes, the theology and the system, the status quo, are a sort of ratcheting up one way or the other. They can go more towards egalitarianism, towards democracy, towards equality, or freedom, or they can go more towards authoritarianism, to patriarchy, to privilege. Yeah, and they both use theology, or they both use the law to enforce the system that they aspire to, and not just the status quo as is, but they reinvent the status quo afterwards to justify what's going to become part of the future. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Mark. Yes, you've got to go.
I think we're going to have to wind this up fairly soon. Yep, getting on a bit.
Do you want
to? I hate to say it, but are you still recording?
Yes.
Do you want to make Diana's point the last one, and then I'll do the closing remarks?
Yes, okay.
Well, go on, Diana.
First of all, I promise I've never, ever got drunk at a party. You can read everything I say. But one important aspect of the patriarchy, and probably the main reason for it, which I forgot to mention, is, and misogyny goes with it, is that women always, everybody knows who their mother is, but they can't be sure who dad is, because you can have it off with anyone. So the patriarchy was subjugated women and invented marriage I think marriage, there were forms of marriage before that, so that's a bit wrong, but it was the form of marriage to ensure that the men knew who their children were. They could have ownership of children, and it actually made children into their pieces of property. So that's what one probably main aspect of it. Well, never get married.
You want to respond to that before I make the closing remarks?
Yeah, I think if you're going to follow the Christian church, you will see that at various times the church has elevated marriage. It has elevated virginity and celibacy. It has abandoned them when it suited them. Yes, they are not part of the theology that is really the essentials of life. They are about how can I control this group of people to extract the maximum amount of finance. When virgins joined the or when women joined the nunneries, then their dowries were given to the church. That made becoming a nun an extremely profitable thing for, families with wealth and for the church. When it became obvious that the church was missing out on priests being married because they would have children, and because they were respected members of society, they'd have lots of children, then suddenly it became the thing that the church had to be celibate, and clergy could not hand over any portion of their wealth to the church. You know, all of these things are movable feasts. They are things that are done for the financial well-being of the institution, which is the religious institution. Yes, but there will always be a fight between those who join a religion because they feel inspired by it and those who see it as a path to power. Yeah? And I'm afraid women, just as much as men, are caught up in that, because the constant pressure to earn, to be master of the house, is not necessarily a pleasant one. And I'm sure it combines to, you know, if there are women who, you know, complain about being oppressed and victimized, there are just as many men who take those responsibilities seriously and, you know, drive themselves into an early grave trying to support people that they have no chance in a capitalist society of ever doing so to their satisfaction. It is a difficult thing, and we are all trapped by it. And this is why I think so many people struggle to find a better understanding of the religion that they value.
Mm.
And they want spirituality. They want to be able to believe in a faith. But what they get is a legal sort of contract where they don't get to know what the full implications of the contract will be, because often they're born into it or they're persuaded about its divine or moral authority.
And incidentally, you mentioned about needing a faith.
Yes.
The famous quote by Marx is that religion is the opening of the masses, but what most people don't realise is that's not even the full quote.
No.
Nope. So I find it really annoying that people use that same quote to disparage religion. But Marx actually went on to say something a bit more than that.
Yep.
He basically meant it was basically a cry of hope and that sort of thing, to do with what people were going through at the time. So we'll have to find that quote then read it in full. I am aware that it's not actually the full quote.
No.
And I find it very unhelpful that to fellow Marxists use it in that way. Which means that they haven't understood what Marx actually meant. They just use it as a way to despise religion. But if we've learned anything from this talk, it's the fact that material circumstances of any epoch in the time of religion, whatever it's going for at the time, it's not completely separate from the material circumstances of the day, whichever country you're in.
I've got to go now.
Thank you very much, Susan.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's helpful.
Not so
anyway, much.